upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We brought all evil into some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Cast. I am Vicky.
I am barely Janelle.
Oh, no. I just hope and pray Janelle does not sound on me right now. It's fine. We'll be fine.
It's fine.
It's all good.
I've survived way worse.
If this is your first time listening, a special hello to you. Got a good show for you, as always, as I always say. That should be one of our catchphrases. Got a good show for you. But first, let's head over to the newsroom. Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad. This week, our story takes us to Arkansas, where a man is accused of breaking into his ex-wife's house to steal a Dr. Pepper.
Just one?
So officers responded for a report of a burglary, and they saw the smashed window, and it was the owner's ex-husband holding a Dr. Pepper he'd taken from the refrigerator.
I mean, if you're going to steal, go hard. Get his, the whole case.
Yeah, right. I mean, if it's in the fridge, at least it's like, just like, I would assume it's not like the plastic can things, but who knows. Denisho Goodwin, 37, was the man who broke into the house. Mm-hmm. Officers confronted him. He became angry and aggressive and then started to curse at the officers. And then he threatened to kill the police officers when they tried to handcuff him. And of course, at this point, he actually has a no contact order with his ex-wife.
I was going to say with the Pepsi.
With the Dr. Pepper. No contact with Dr. Pepper.
Is it a Pepsi?
The doctor has filed a no contact order. Please do not contact him.
It'd be so much better if you took the wife out of it. And just said Dr. Robert.
the good doctor. Uh-huh. So Goodwin was arrested. He was charged with 6 misdemeanors and 2 felonies, including threatening, burglary, and theft of property. How do you return it? It's in his stomach.
But also, like, it's under a certain amount. Like,
I don't know.
You charge someone for a dollar can of soda.
I don't know. Apparently, you get burglary for that. God. In Arkansas, anyway. All right.
That's soda pop country.
It's a soda tax. Mm-hmm. We're going to move on to Netflix and Kill. This week, we are talking about a documentary called Who Killed Little Gregory?
I have seen that.
You have?
Yeah.
So, it is, first of all, it takes place in France. And I
so
say
it's
that
hard.
Yeah, I say that because it's in French, but it's subbed on the, or not subbed, well, part subtitles, part dubbed over in English, which
I hate dub overs.
I hate dub overs, so you know. But at the same time, it's like I can watch this right before I go to bed and not have to, like.
And then your brain will translate it for you.
Yeah, right. It's like, I can speak French now.
That's how it works. You sleep on the French book.
Yeah, it just absorbs. Mm-hmm. So this is the story of Gregory Villemay, who was like four. Mm-hmm. He's four
just
years
a baby
old.
Boy.
Just a little boy. He disappeared from his home and was found in the Valone River near Dosselle. It is like this little village area. In France, and of course his parents Jean-Marie and Christine Villemay, they were completely distraught by this. Now, big time spoiler alerts if you have not watched this or don't know about the case.
Turn it off if you have not seen this or heard this.
So the whole premise, at least of the first part, is they're talking about a man that they, or a person that they've started referring to as the crow? No, the raven? The crow.
Craven. Rogue Craven. The Craven. We'll call it the Craven.
The Craven. And this was a person who for months and months and months beforehand was sending them these really mysterious and threatening letters and
like the
phone
watcher.
Calls. Yeah. They were getting phone calls from this person that were threats. And it seemed that this person had a lot of knowledge about the family and some of the inner workings and things. And so they initially, well, and I think still assume that the person who was the crow was also the person who murdered Gregory. Mm-hmm. And this is all, of course, in the initial investigation, which very quickly afterwards goes completely off the rails.
Bananas.
It is. The case itself is extremely interesting. There were a lot of people accused, a lot of people arrested, almost all of them within the family. Mm-hmm. The initial suspect was a family member named Bernard LaRoche, who was a cousin of Jean-Marie, and he was arrested. And there was some testimony from his sister-in-law that was like placed him at the time of the murder and then later was recanted, and she was 15, and there was some thoughts that maybe she had been like beaten when she got home by the family. Mm-hmm. That forced her to retract all of that. And then they suspected Christine herself, and then Jean-Marie kind of loses it and shoots Bernard LaRoche dead because he still thinks he's the murderer. He goes to jail, and then it's this whole crazy thing.
Yes. It's a saga.
The one consistent thing through this entire story is the role that the media played. Mm-hmm. Which, if you want to talk about media circus, this is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What are your thoughts on, because you've seen this, what are your thoughts on this as a whole?
This one is a little long-winded.
I will, yeah, this one, as far, like, this,
a little long-winded.
The content is good, but it seemed to drag a little bit. Yeah. It was kind of hard to follow, but that's because the story itself is really
hard
to follow.
It's very confusing. It's very hard to follow. There's so much conspiracy around it.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's very like murder mystery. The whole case itself is just like this big bumbling fucking
disaster.
Disaster.
Yeah.
And it just pits family members against family members, and the media just does whatever they want. Whenever they want, it's like there's no rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. They're just like up in these people's faces at their homes, at their place of business, just like all over the place.
And it's a tiny, I mean, they descended on this tiny town who had never had media coverage like that ever for anything. And people were, by the end of it, like so annoyed with the constant like media presence. But they were like forcing their way into the police station and into the courtrooms and trying to insert themselves with members of the family, and like there were definitely like there was the pro LaRoche camp and the anti LaRoche camp, and like, oh my god, it was so divisive. But it's worth a watch. I mean, I would say we do caution you because it is like kind of tough to get through. And I think it's just because it's a lot. It is a lot. It drags a little bit and you kind of got to sift through some of the garbage. But like, it's definitely worth watching just for info on the case, because this is not one that I was familiar with at all. It's definitely worth a watch. So it's called Who Killed Little Gregory? It is on Netflix now. Check it out. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We are talking about murder.
Duh.
some pretty gory stuff.
Mine's not gory.
Mine kind of is. child death. Mm. I know on mine. You got any specific warnings?
Nope.
Okay. Let's get started then. I was thinking, what could I use now more than a vacation? Except now that I'm thinking, now that we've done research, part of me is like, I should never take a vacation again in my entire life.
Yeah.
We're looking at some murders that happened while folks are on vacation, a time that should be comfortable and freeing.
Not always.
Apparently not. So I am going to be looking at the murder of the Rogers women. So we're going to start actually with Oba Chandler. He was born October 11th, 1946, and he was the fourth of five children. His parents, Oba Chandler Sr. and Margaret Johnson, raised him and his siblings in Cincinnati, Ohio. Unfortunately, at the age of 10, Chandler's father hanged himself in the family basement, or in the basement of the family apartment. And this affected him greatly, which was most evident at the funeral when he reported he reportedly jumped into his father's grave as it was being covered in dirt. I saw one of the descriptions saying that they would, like, every time they would throw dirt onto the coffin, he'd, like, jump down in there and, like, stamp it down. So I don't know if it was, like, an emotional thing or if it was just, like, a kid being a kid, like, trying to help, quote unquote, help. Who knows? In his adult years, Chandler was the father of 13 children from 12 mothers.
Okay.
four of which were given up for adoption. By this point, he had managed to accumulate quite the police record. After being arrested 20 times as a juvenile, mainly for stealing cars. In adulthood, he was charged with possession of counterfeit money, loitering, burglary, kidnapping, and armed robbery, among other things. He had even been accused of masturbating while looking into a woman's window and receiving 21 wigs stolen from a beauty parlor.
I mean, you know.
It's like different ends of the crime spectrum.
It's like good packaging. Yeah.
There was another incident in which Chandler and an accomplice robbed a Florida couple at gunpoint after breaking into their home. On May 26, 1989, Joan Rogers, who was 36 at the time, and her two daughters, Michelle, who was 17, and Chrissy, who was 14, were traveling back to their home in Ohio after visiting Disney World in Orlando. It was the very first time the family had left their home state of Ohio to vacation. They went to Florida. It's a very Midwest thing to, like, the first time you leave, you go down to Florida or you go up north to Wisconsin and, like, go camping. Like, that's a... At least here in Illinois, that's the very, like, Midwest thing to do. Authorities believe that after leaving Orlando around 9 a.m. while on their way home, they became a bit lost and then decided to just take an extra vacation day in Tampa, Florida. While searching for their hotel, they met Oba Chandler, who graciously wrote down some directions to the Days Inn for the Rogers women. Chandler also offered to take the three women on a sunset cruise on his boat called the Gypsy One. They accepted and continued on to their hotel, arriving at the hotel around 12:30 p.m. The Rogers family hung around the hotel taking pictures and such and eating dinner at the hotel restaurant around 7:30. Photos from a roll of film found in the room show that the girls were still there just as sunset began, but the time in the restaurant at like 7:30, that was the last time that they were actually seen alive. Authorities believe Rogers met Chandler at his boat on the Courtney Campbell Causeway between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m. and that they had been murdered by 3 a.m. the following morning. However, their bodies weren't found until the following week. Housekeeping staff at the Days Inn noticed that their room had remained empty for a whole week, and obviously, like, they hadn't checked out at that point.
Yeah.
They informed the manager, who immediately phoned police, and as they began their search, police found the Rogers car abandoned next to a boat ramp off of the Courtney Campbell Causeway. Upon searching for the car, they discovered a brochure with written directions, and they continued their search, and on June 4th, several people on a sailboat going underneath the Sunshine Skyway saw an object in the water, and this was the first body found of the Rogers family. The second was discovered off of the pier in St. Petersburg, approximately 2 miles north of the first. And literally, like, as the Coast Guard was pulling the second body out, they got the call of the discovery of the third that was just east of the pier where they were at. All three women were found with their legs and arms bound in a cinder block tied by a rope around their neck. And they were also naked from the waist down. Autopsies showed water in the lungs of all three women, indicating that they had been alive before being thrown into the water. It took another week for the women to be positively identified. And at that point, their father and husband, Hal Rogers, had filed a missing persons report in Ohio. And of course, they're being discovered down in Florida. So mm-hmm. it takes a little bit to like get that connection. Police had been able to pull fingerprints from the Days Inn hotel room and match those to the bodies that had been recovered. This, along with a final match of dental records, proved that the bodies were those of Joan, Michelle, and Christy Rogers. And so an investigation began into the murders of the Rogers women and how they ended up in the water, because that's not just somewhere you end up.
You don't just tie yourself up and throw yourself in.
Not the last time I checked. Nope. Our resident kitten just came in for the height of the story. So they began looking into how they ended up in the water. And according to marine researchers from the University of South Florida, they were able to study the currents and patterns in the water to determine that they had been thrown from the boat versus like being thrown in from dry land or from a bridge. Mm-hmm. Police began asking the public for any tips in the case, which they definitely like got an influx of, which is part of the reason why it took so long to find the person that they had killed them, is they were just like sifting through all of these tips that they had gotten. The most important seemed to come from a police bulletin regarding the investigation into a similar rape in the area that had occurred just 2 weeks beforehand. Judy Blair, the victim of the rape, said that she had met a man that offered to take her on a sunset cruise on his boat. Without a second thought, she went on a ride with the man through Tampa Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. And while they were gone, she was raped and believed that had it not been for her friend who was waiting for her back on the dock, she also would have been killed. But because there was like somebody expecting her back, she's like pretty sure that's what saved her life. So Judy Blair went in and made a composite drawing that was printed in the newspaper, along with info about both the rape and the triple murder. And I know how you feel about composite drawings. I could not find what this one looked like, but it seemed to help in this case. Police believed the handwriting found on the brochure in the car held the key to who the killer was, and posted images of the handwriting on billboards around the Tampa area.
That's an interesting way.
It is, yeah. This was actually the first time that U.S. law enforcement used billboards in this way, and this kind of like set the precedent to use it for future missing persons cases, which is a plus. I mean, that's like, I think that's a positive way to like use the billboards. Not long after the sketch in the newspaper and the billboards went up, Chandler fled the area, selling his boat before he left. Luckily, a former neighbor of Chandler's recognized the handwriting from the billboard and called the police. The neighbor was actually able to provide a copy of a work order that Chandler had written for them that they had. And they took this work order, put it through a handwriting analysis from an expert, and the two were a match. And so between the investigation, putting the info out into the public, and Chandler fleeing with his family, because he was married with kids at this point, it took 3 years before he was arrested for the murders of Joan, Michelle, and Christy in September of 1992. Yeah, I was a little surprised by that.
Yeah.
And I know it just had to do with getting the right tip in, but the fact that he just like fled.
Yeah.
I'm sure that slowed everything down. Mm-hmm. Chandler, of course, denied murdering the women. In testimony during his trial, Chandler had said he only met the women briefly when he had given them directions, but then he was out fishing alone the night the murders occurred. He had to admit that he was on Tampa Bay at that evening because he was confronted with records of 3 ship-to-shore calls and that from that night. But even still, like, he claimed that he was alone fishing. And in explaining his late return to shore, he had said that his engine didn't start from what was a suspected gas leak. He claimed to have called the Coast Guard and the Florida Marine Patrol and attempted to flag down a patrol boat, but all were too busy to help. After some time fixing, he like fixed the line with duct tape, just like put duct tape on it. Mm-hmm. And then he was able to return to shore. Now, this, of course, was in direct conflict with a record of Coast Guard and Marine Patrol movement that evening. Neither agency had any records of distress calls, nor did they have any records that any boats were out on the bay that morning that could have helped them. So they're kind of like, yeah, we don't think so. We don't know about this. There was also testimony from a boat mechanic that I could speak to better if I knew anything about motors. But essentially, it's the model boat that he had. Mm-hmm. The fuel lines were directed upward. And so if there was a gas leak, the gas would have been like spraying into the air instead of down into the boat. And he also pointed out that the gasoline would have dissolved the adhesive on the duct tape. So like there was no way that you could just like put duct tape around it and call it a day. Mm-hmm. Of course, Judy Blair testified at trial as well regarding the rape to show a pattern of attack and similarities between her attack and the murder of the Rogers woman. She had given Blair a fake name, or I'm sorry, Chandler had given Blair a fake name of David Posner, and he had told her that he worked on aluminum siding, which, you know, I love.
A fake job.
Not a fake job, but, and actually, I'm pretty sure that's
it's
how
a
the
con man job.
It sounds like it, right? Well, and it was definitely like an under the table, off the record, aluminum siding contractor, essentially. And I'm pretty sure that's how the neighbor got the work order from him, is because he did their aluminum siding. You know how I love my operation names.
Yes.
So that whole thing about him being an aluminum siding contractor, that is also how this whole case got the name Operation Tin Man.
Except aluminum and tin are two different things, but okay.
I mean, I don't think they're going for accuracy. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be on the same punch if it was Operation Aluminum Man.
Yes, Operation Aluminum Foil.
Whoa. Oh, that would have been really good.
Because yes, a foil.
Man,
be
they
so
dropped.
Many things.
They oh my God. Man, ball. They dropped the ball on that one. That would have been so good. But they called it Operation
Tin Man. Pretty good, though.
Yeah. Blair then went on to detail the rape. It was also revealed in court testimony that the man who purchased the boat from Chandler, his name is Robert Carlton. He bought the boat when Chandler was fleeing Florida. He testified that he received the boat in like spotless condition, like totally
suspect.
Spotless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He also recalled seeing concrete blocks like sitting outside of Chandler's residence when he went to go pick the boat up that were similar to the blocks that the Rogers women were found with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not uncommon for people to use those as weights.
Right, right.
So if you were to set it like on the boat, there's a couple blocks tied together. Mm-hmm. They're going to be like, oh, okay. But you're at his house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's given the extenuating circumstances, I would say it's a little suspect. Mm-hmm. Although in normal day, like everyday life, it would not be. Then Chandler's daughter, Crystal Mays, testified saying that he had left when she was 7 and they hadn't reconnected until the mid 80s when she hired a private detective to find him. When he was found, he was incarcerated in Florida. And so like Mays, along with her sister, Valerie Lynn Troxell, went to go visit him. And like before this, they had not really had a relationship with him at all. She then testified that in November 1989, she received a phone message with the phone number of a Cincinnati motel where he could be reached. So Crystal Mays and her husband went to the motel where they found Chandler in like this very nervous, anxious state. They talked about how when they went into the room, there was like a shit ton of cups of coffee and like ashtrays just filled to the brim. And he was like obviously very agitated. Mm-hmm. They noticed his Jeep had been backed in front of another building, not the building he was staying in, but a totally separate building, and that he had backed it in order to obscure his license plate.
Makes sense.
I mean, if you're running from something, it does. Mm-hmm. When they entered the room, Chandler told the couple that he couldn't go back to Florida because police were looking for him for a rape. Didn't say anything about the murder. Never said he was guilty of the rape or murder, but just that police were looking for him. He then instructed the family not to tell anyone where he was, and they just, like, never spoke of it again. It's like, okay.
Okay.
So after this entire trial, ultimately Chandler was found guilty on November 4th, 1994. He was sentenced to death and continued to maintain his innocence. And he spent the next few years on Florida's death row pursuing appeals. Later, he would admit to the rape of Judy Blair, but insisted that it had been consensual and that Blair changed her mind halfway through. Because that is how it works.
Yeah, totally.
So it just,
I half raped her.
Yeah. Yeah. I read that and I was like, oh my God, that's so infuriating. Like, yeah. And even if she had changed her mind, then you get the fuck off.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors made a conscious decision not to prosecute Chandler for the rape since he had already been sentenced to death, and to avoid emotional trauma for Blair to come back into court and re-testify about this rape. It sounded to me like they had discussed this with her and that she was fine with it. I don't know for sure that they had, but it didn't seem to me like Blair was, like, actively trying to pursue prosecution for it. Not long after the guilty conviction, Chandler's wife filed for divorce. And he was barred from seeing, yeah, he was barred from seeing their daughter or, like, even having any pictures of her or anything in prison. Interestingly enough, in 2001, Chandler's name was invoked yet again when investigators were looking into a discovery of a fourth woman's body in 1989. She had been found floating off Anna Maria Island with a white rope tied to a concrete block that had been tied to her chest and waist. So you can see some similarities. There were quite a few more hurdles in that case, though, because the woman had never been identified. And Chandler still had not admitted guilt in the murder of the Rogers women. So, like, he definitely did not admit guilt to any additional crimes. While it appeared to be similar at the outset, the Rogers women had actually been stripped from the waist down, and the Jane Doe that they had found was still wearing pants, which is, sounds like a small difference, but it is a big difference when you're talking MOs. Profiling experts have speculated that Chandler may have killed previously, as it was, like, really bold to abduct three women at one time.
Yeah.
It's not something that you typically see with what you would consider unexperienced killers. It's really only something that you see with people who have killed before and are, like, kind of know how it all works. In the case of the Jane Doe, she was eventually identified as 29-year-old Amy Hurst. She was identified in 2001 with the use of DNA. And her husband was arrested and charged with her murder shortly thereafter. So he was cleared of that one. Chandler's final appeal was filed in May of 2007. It was denied along with all of his previous appeals. On October 10th, 2011, Florida Governor Rick Scott signed Chandler's death warrant, and his execution date was set for November 15th. He was executed at 4:08 p.m. at the Florida State Prison in Rayford. And while he didn't have an official recorded last statement, he had left a written statement with one of the prison guards that said, quote, "You are killing an innocent man today." His final meal was two salami sandwiches on white bread with mustard. He requested a peanut butter and grape jelly. I know. It's all boring. He requested a peanut butter and grape jelly sandwich on white bread, but only ate half of it. And he had ordered an iced tea, but drank coffee instead. I know.
Basic.
He's originally from Ohio. We're not exciting up here.
But I mean, there's so much more. Like, you could have just a sandwich.
And not even, this is what kills me, not even with cheese.
Yeah.
Salami and mustard on white.
It's classic.
Oh, no thank you.
It's classic school lunch.
So he was executed on the 15th. Now, in an interesting turn of events, in February 2014, police were able to use DNA to identify Chandler in another Florida cold case. 23-year-old Oh boy, here we go. Okay, sorry. I'm going to apologize away in advance.
Oh, no.
23-year-old Ivalice Berrios Biguris. I'm sorry. Ivalice. She was discovered dead in November 1990. She was last seen leaving work at the Sawgrass Mills Mall, which was kind of in the same area that he was at in Florida. Her husband went to find her and called police after finding her car with two slashed tires. 3 hours later, police discovered her body with ligature marks on both wrists and ankles and brown packing tape stuck in her hair. Authority believe that after watching Ivalice for 2 days, Chandler slashed her tires and then showed up as the Good Samaritan offering some help. Seems you got a car breakdown there. I can help you. I'll just get in my car. It's like, nope. No, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Two slashed tires. So. Call the police right away.
Oh, my God. Totally.
Do not pass go.
Yeah. And the issue is it would have been in 1990. Mm-hmm. Still even in the early 90s, like, hitchhiking, getting into cars with strangers was still pretty common.
You go to the mall and use a payphone. That's a thing.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is it's not like they had cell phones to just like call 911. She would have had to go in. But there's this Good Samaritan that just came along that happened to be here. And now I don't have to go in and do all that. He could just take me home. Because it sounded like she didn't live far from there either. So DNA was collected in the 90s, but 90s testing ain't got nothing on modern day DNA testing, as we can tell with things like genetic family trees and all of this stuff. That's like, even thinking back to the 90s, like nothing.
They're like, this is a one in a bajillion maybe possibility.
So they were able to test it, and it did come back positive for Chandler. Police have said that were Chandler still alive, he would be charged with the crime. And they do continue to look into cold cases in the area that Chandler was known to reside. So it seems to me that the criminal profiler was pretty on point when he said the fact that he had abducted three women at one time was pretty bold for somebody who would have been killing for the first time.
Yeah.
And so I personally think there may be more out there, but it takes a long time to reopen and reinvestigate cases.
Yeah. And that's to say if someone was even found.
Right. Right.
If they just remain missing and there's absolutely no evidence, there's no one to, DNA
exactly.
test.
Although I do find it interesting that if he had killed before, that in the case of Judy Blair, he would have let her go. I mean, I know like having somebody waiting on you seemed to be the reason that he let her go. But like also at the same time, I think.
I mean, someone could have saw them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that could have scared him enough.
Yeah. I'm trying to think in the cases of known serial killers and people that have been studied, if that was something that happened. But even then, like in the 90s, it was not very common to report rapes or sexual assaults. And like even in her telling and testimony, she talked about how she went back. She just wanted to go home and take a shower. Didn't tell her parents. She did tell the friend she was with as soon as like her parents had left. But after that, it was just they just kind of like dropped it, you know. Yeah. So, but that is the story of the murder of the Rogers women.
All right, so for mine, I too will take you to a tropical locale.
I mean, do you really vacation any other places?
I don't like tropical locales.
No?
Nope.
You'd rather go in a forest?
Yeah, somewhere where there's mountains, or I really like this. I like the Southwest.
Okay.
I mean, not all the murder and all the
Pacific Northwest is where it's at for me.
People living in disparity, but you know, yes. I like cactuses.
Yeah, I like the warm
good cactus. So I I don't know if you remember that I went to the Dominican Republic for my brother's destination wedding.
I do remember.
All the saltiness in that sentence.
I didn't hear any. It sounded like you had a lovely time.
It was wonderful. The piña coladas. But after like 2 weeks after we had left, there was like a rash of people dying in the Dominican Republic.
Oh, yeah.
And one woman was beaten in a resort that was right next to ours. Like, guy took a shirt from the resort, like, that made him look like he worked there, drug her into a fucking basement engineering room, and beat her. And that was it. Didn't do any, didn't steal, just beat her.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's fucked up.
Did he... Part of me feels like that would be something that would be like an attempted rape.
I would think so, yeah.
And then he thought midway through, this is way too much trouble than it's worth, if she was like fighting back, mm-hmm. just like beat the shit out of her. Like, beat, I could see that happening. Because that is weird to just pull somebody aside and beat them. Then leave.
Mm-hmm. That's wild. So I was really excited to hear that and made me want to not travel anywhere ever again, especially to a fucking island.
It made me never want to leave my house.
But it got me thinking about the Dominican Republic and mm-hmm. what other crimes have happened there.
Lots.
And lots.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So this story is going to take place opposite side of the island than I was at. This is where people would be considered the real DR. I'm gonna refer to it as DR intermittently.
Okay. So this would be like not necessarily the destination part, but like where people live.
Yeah, where people live. There are places in these sides of the island where you can like rent villas.
Okay.
But it is not the most touristy side of the island.
Okay.
So Daryl Fornatura was a 45-year-old tennis bro who was recently divorced, kind of living his best bachelor life.
I thought you said tennis bro for a second.
I mean, he does look a little broly. So he'd be a tennis pro bro.
Oh, no.
He was an avid surfer, and he enjoyed traveling around the world. His sister described him as just living life big. That's how he was. He loved to surf. I mean, he worked to surf. It was his passion. He loved it. Women, surf, and food. And that's pretty much what made him tick in that order. So, you know,
he does look
very,
like a tennis bro.
Very bachelory.
Yes. I can see that.
Mm-hmm. He particularly liked to vacation in areas that are known for really interesting and surf spots. And that's what kind of led him to go to the DR, the Dominican Republic. He and his friend Matt Rigby, who was like a small plane pilot, mm-hmm. which is kind of an interesting key point into this story, decided to take a 6-day surfing vacation trip to a rented villa in the town of Cabaretta. And that's like a small fishing town on the north coast of the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
Rigby piloted a plane and they landed in the town of Puerto Plata on January 26, 2016. They rented a car and drove to their rented villa in the Perla Marina, which is 10 minutes outside of the town of Cabaretta. Fornaturo kept his parents in the loop the entire time. He was checking in with his mom. He kept, like, sending her updates, like, we just landed.
Yeah.
Get in the car.
Good
like,
for him.
Really on it.
Yeah, that's good. I feel I am the worst at that. Like, if you ask my mom, there have definitely been times where I'll go away and then just, like, not say anything for, like, 3 days. And then she'll be like,
are you alive?
That's when you get the text that's like, are you dead? Question mark. Not this time.
Not yet. So at 6:28 on that Tuesday, Fornatura texted his mother that he was going on an epic day, spending 5 hours in the water.
Nice. Sounds pretty epic.
It's like, shred. Shredding up them waves. So after this time, his mother, Nancy, had not heard anything from him at all. So that was the last time he texted her. So she grew a little concerned.
Okay.
But she, you know, was like, he's a grown fucking man. She kind of shrugged it off at first and went to bed that night. Now, when it came to be Thursday, she was really concerned. Both his parents started to worry. They started making phone calls to other friends and his place of work to see if maybe he checked in with anyone else. Mm-hmm. They hadn't heard anything from him. No texts, no emails, nothing. So,
okay.
8:30 a.m. that Friday, Fornaturo, his parents, received a phone call from Matt Rigby.
All right.
He stated that
that's
he,
the friend?
Yes,
with
the one he was with.
Okay.
He had stated that he had not heard from Daryl since Wednesday, Okay, and this is Friday.
Okay.
According to Rigby, Daryl was leaving on a surf scout to the nearby town of Soosa with a man named Gaspar. Daryl and Matt had rented surfboards from Gaspar the day before, so they were kind of familiar with him. He's like, I can take you to a nice surfing spot. Mm-hmm. So Daryl went on his own. Hours later, Daryl allegedly returned to the villa, acting extremely paranoid. And this is what Matt said. Daryl is behaving strangely, saying he wanted to get out of there. And he's like, let's fly home. Let's go. So Rigby told him that it would be fine. He shouldn't be so paranoid. He suggested that they go into town and shop around the local market, kind of relax, mm-hmm. shake it off, maybe not, you know, go out for the on the water that day, kind of take it slow.
Yeah.
So they head into town, and Matt steps into a store, and when he comes back outside, Daryl had vanished.
Okay. I'm instantly already distrustful of this mad guy.
Yeah.
Because I always feel like anytime you're getting this, like, this type of story from one person, in any mm-hmm. case, it's always like, yeah, but that sounds like kind of a load of bullshit.
Just a little. Okay. Just a scotch of BS.
Yeah.
Now, the Fornituras asked Rigby of the status of the hunt for their son in the DR. To their shock, Rigby stated he was back in West Palm Beach, calling them from Daryl's office.
Oh.
As he was looking for their phone number, because his phone was gone.
So he oh my god.
So he flew back to good Florida.
What a good friend. My friend is missing on this island. I'm going to leave now. Mm-hmm. Cool. Cool guy.
Yep. According to the reports that I read, Rigby never called the police or the U.S. Embassy in the Dominican Republic. Now, after he informs the Fornituros, he then flies back to the Dominican Republic. So he flies to Florida, tells them, waits a day, and flies back to the DR.
Okay.
With him is his wife and $5,000 to pay for a private search and rescue man. Now, a private search and rescue man is kind of like a PI down there.
Okay.
They usually handle people who are missing in other countries.
Okay, so still not like going to the embassy or anything.
Nope.
Okay, sure.
Now, the man's name was Leon Alter, and he was a Canadian expat and founder of Crime Stoppers Dominican Republic. And he was hired to hunt for Daryl. When the Fornituros called the embassy to check on this guy, all they could say was that he was involved and had no other information. So really fucking sketchy.
Right.
Now, Daryl's sister, Christina, and her husband decided to head down there to see what the fuck was up. Like, they were like, no one is calling the police. No one is actively putting in anything at the embassy. Like, we need to go down there.
Yeah.
So she flies down there. And she arrives and gets to Cabaretta. And she had made arrangements before she left to meet up with Rigby, Matt Rigby, to make sure that she knew where she was going, where mm-hmm. the villa was, what places to check out. So she calls him. And he goes, oh, man, me and my wife had just flown back.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Sure. Because you totally didn't know they were coming.
Mm-mm, not at all.
Oh my god, this is so sketchy. This is sketchy as fuck.
Now, once Daryl's sister and brother-in-law see Cabaretta, they realize just how fucked up this place is and how fucked this whole case is going to be.
Oh god.
Now, Cabaretta, according to Christina, is isolated and the wild, wild west of the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
And she stated this in an interview. The countless stories we heard of tourists being drugged, their drinks being drugged, marijuana being laced, set up with prostitutes, set up by driving, being stopped on the road by police, and give me $1,000 or you're under arrest situations. And interestingly, when we uncovered all of these stories, the common theme for those were targeted were single Western males.
Okay.
So they're painting this picture. There's a lot of kind of corrupt kind of activities happening in this town in particular.
Yeah. Now, do you get the feeling that it is actually like that down there, or do you feel like it's being colored by like Western?
Yes.
Okay, it is actually like that. Well, I think that's a fair question, because it's easy for somebody from the mainland to come back and be like, this place is fucking crazy.
I was on the resort side, which is considered the safe side, and the beaches are still public over there, but they have resort police that stand outside the resort on the public beach to make sure that people aren't bothering the tourists.
Okay.
And we were out there at 9 o'clock at night, maybe. There's no, like, out when it's that late, there's no lifeguard or in the resort police aren't out there at night.
Yeah.
But you can still walk the beach and you can still sit in the villas that are connected to your resort. And there were people walking around trying to sell things to you.
Oh, my God.
But, like, shady stuff.
Yeah.
We had, like four drugs? People trying to sell us drugs within a span of 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And we're like, no, thank you. No, thank you. We wanted to take a picture of the beach at night. Please tempting, go away.
But nah.
Not at all tempting if you saw these people.
No, I'm sure. Like, no. Okay, so it is actually. Because there is, I think there is this kind of. Sometimes, I'm not saying in this case, but sometimes there is like an overbuilt perception of people who live in Western culture that you go to some of these places and it might not be that bad, but it's like, holy fuck, this place is really bad. You would never, but like if it's actually like that, then okay.
And the fact that people, so what wound up happening to those people who had died in the Dominican Republic was that their alcohol in their mini fridge was laced with something. They said in the newspaper that it was bad alcohol. They had, something was intentionally put into those things and sealed.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So there's a lot of push in a couple of the islands down there to not be resort towns anymore. But that is the main job of a lot of people.
Yeah, they would have, like, no industry if that stuff was pulled out of there. Exactly.
So it is this catch-22 in a lot of places. And I get it. Resorts ruin your natural habitat. They ruin the economy of the people that are living there. I get it.
Yeah.
I don't like to go to places where the only industry is
resorts, vacation, and tourism, yeah.
That's just me. I would have never gone to the Dominican Republic if my brother hadn't gotten married there.
Yeah.
I would have never, ever gone.
Yeah.
I just don't feel that that is right.
Yeah. No, I get it. I have,
opinions, obviously.
Yeah. just on this, you say?
Just a little bit of an opinion. So, bear that in mind as we're going through this. But the drugging people, definitely. I've heard lots of stories of people being drugged and robbed.
Yeah.
Not too much about people being hurt. So this is the interesting part. Now, I'm going to give you some cautionary trip advice, okay? This is going to be Janelle's
life pro
trip
tips.
Corner, okay? Especially if you're a U.S. citizen. First of all, pretend you're British. Don't tell anyone you're from the U.S. Put on that fake accent. Whenever someone asks you where you're from and you say the U.S.
Canada? Can you get away with
Canada?
Canada
would be good, too. Okay. Yeah.
Canada would be easier
in
for
certain,
us United
in
States
certain
people.
Countries, don't say you're from the U.S.
No. Actually, in most countries, just don't say you're from the U.S.
Second,
at this point.
Research the area you're going to. I mean, really fucking research it. Not like the best 10 spots to be in the sun. Like, research the area. Third, if you want to go somewhere exotic and unattained, don't. I mean it. Don't do it. Don't fucking go. You will die.
Yep. Yep.
And if you really, 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 really want to go, okay, you're an idiot, first of all. But second, hire a reputable person to escort you no matter the cost. If you're going to fucking go to the Amazon forest, fucking hire someone to take you.
Yeah.
Don't just be like, I read it on Travel Guide. I can do that. TripAdvisor told me where to go.
No.
No. You don't know the area.
Yeah.
You already had to take a million shots to get there. Take the fucking hint. Maybe you don't belong, but also if you want to go, fucking prepare yourself, okay?
Right.
And if you know someone who is a national to that country, ask them to be your escort. If you have a friend who's already living in that country, ask them to take you around.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always better to be seen with someone who speaks the language, who is a native.
Well, and they're going to know, like, places to stay away from, places that are safe. Places that are,
just do your due diligence. We were planning on going to Japan, which is very friendly, but we are still going to have someone who we know that is friends with us, who lives there part-time, escort us around.
Yeah.
It's just better.
Man,
just
talk about a language difference. Ooh,
oh, yeah. I mean, there's really great apps that you can do a lot of conversions, but
Even Google Translate has gotten way better.
Yeah.
Way, way better.
But in certain places where it's like the entire country is developing and, you know, when I heard we were going to the DR, I went on. There's like a U.S. travel list that you can go on to see where the how cautious you need to be when you're traveling to certain places.
Yeah.
I know that sounds a little like scary, but check it out. See why people suggest to have caution. There's a lot of political and socioeconomical things happening in countries that we don't see in the news.
Yes.
And we don't understand.
Yeah. True.
And genocides and civil wars that are occurring in smaller countries that we will never know about until we decide to fucking travel there. So do your homework. And you'll know why you're not supposed to go into that one town where you could get kidnapped.
Exactly. I agree with all of these points.
So, the Fornituros decided to be smart, and Christina and her husband hired an escort on the island to guide them around. They attempted to solicit help from local authorities to no avail. Everything had a price. Everything that they were asking people to help them with had a fucking price. So they were having difficulties. They put up a bunch of posters, and as they were going around, they realized that they were being torn down immediately.
Oh.
Not suspicious at all.
Okay.
The Crime Stoppers dude that was supposedly helping them, who was hired by Matt Rigby, was actually not doing anything beyond printing flyers and posting them. He wasn't even doing any research or interviewing people or anything.
God. Yeah.
He didn't go to the embassy. He didn't go to the authorities. He just printed posters.
Well, and the thing
is, $5,000.
Yeah. The thing is even with Crime Stopper organizations, they're not, like, if it's anything related to U.S. Crime Stoppers, they are not an investigative agency. They're not. They are a tip agency.
Yeah, they're like a neighborhood watch.
Yeah,
watch. That's it.
Exactly. Their primary function is to receive tips on cases. So they're not an investigative body. So I, even if it wasn't $5,000, it was just Crime Stoppers doing it out of their goodness of their heart, I really would not have expected them to do anything other than put up flyers. You know?
Exactly. So they kind of started researching a little bit more. They hired their own private detectives.
Good idea.
They also found out that the market that Daryl was in had security cameras.
Okay.
So they attempted to solicit more information about those. Upon further inspection, they realized that dates around the time that he was there were missing. Of course.
Okay.
The guide Gaspar that was hired had also told them that he had no information about Daryl. It also appeared that there were no witnesses from the last place he was seen, and the couple was completely, utterly frustrated, and they decided to return to the U.S. and kind of let the private detectives take over. They had hired three detectives.
Okay.
I think one was in the U.S., one was through the embassy, and one was in the Dominican Republic.
I mean, smart.
You have to, like, kind of cover all your bases.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. Especially when you're talking another country, because... People, as much as I hate to say it, people working within that country may not necessarily have your best interest in mind. And especially when you aren't planning on staying in the country to oversee the investigation, which I get not doing that. Like, it's hard for people to commit months and months and months to, like, living in DR without having a job, like, income coming in, unless they are, like, financially independent completely. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of the detectives, Richard Pimentel, was able to kind of uncover some precarious information.
Okay.
Pimentel was able to track down a promising lead. The last known person who saw Daryl outside the surf shop where Matt Rigby said he last saw his friend. So, this is Pimentel talking. I found a witness, a Canadian national. Her name is Jacqueline Beck. She said that she was walking into town and saw Daryl and Matt walking in front of her, and she noticed that Daryl was acting irrational. And then when Matt went into the store, Daryl approached her and asked her for help. He said, "I need to leave this country." He was paranoid, asking if there were any gangs in Cabaretta, if there were any mobs. She asked him if he had consumed marijuana. He said yes. And then Daryl had panicked a little bit because a couple of kids approached her that were locals, and he backed off from her and left.
So it's, like, sounding more like he had laced, like, something laced in marijuana, you think, that was causing him hallucinations or paranoid thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll get to what I think.
Okay. Actually. Okay. Sorry.
What actually?
This is me reasoning it out as we go. I should stop doing that.
That's okay. Now, Pimentel also tracked down Gaspar again. And according to Gaspar, he wanted to show Daryl a good surfing spot. But he was not really... showing him a good spot. So the spot he was taking him to was in a different area, because he said that he was more familiar with this area. And when they went to the beach, it was the place called Sausa. Now, he was obviously lying, because Sausa is not a good surfing spot.
Okay.
And he was not showing him anything that was special. Gaspar was very shady. People around town called him a player.
Oh, boy.
So someone who's kind of trying to pull fast ones on people. Yeah. Now, Sausa is also known for being a really big hotspot for drugs.
Okay.
And also prostitution.
Oh, great. Okay. Perfect.
So it's kind of like the seediest area in that region.
Like the red light district of DR?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So it is very possible that he could have purchased something that was laced, because that's kind of what they're known for.
Yeah.
Now, Richard Pimentel then met with the local officer in charge of the case and received some pretty shocking fucking information. I wanted to compare notes, and he just cut me off and he said, oh, that case is closed.
Oh.
We have two witnesses that saw him walk into the water and never come out. He drowned. Okay. That case is closed.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. No. What? So, no, that's not. That's what? Okay.
According to the Dominican Replice, witnesses on Cabarita Beach claim they saw Daryl wade into the water and not come back at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that for one second. Yeah. I do not believe that for one second.
Yeah. So in the DR, the news was dead. But in Florida, they kept running a bunch of news stories because the family was from Florida. Mm-hmm. And finally, there seemed to be like this sparkle of hope. After a long segment on his disappearance ran on a local TV station, all of a sudden his wallet washes ashore in the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
Inside of his wallet was his ID, all of his credit cards, and $462 of wet cash.
So it doesn't sound like he was robbed.
No.
If all of that was still in there.
Also gives credence to him walking into the water.
I don't know.
This still did not change the status of the case in the Dominican Republic. And the cherry on top is that Matt Rigby decided to get a lawyer. Okay. Also, another fun fact that we find out is that Matt Rigby had taken all of Daryl's possessions with him when he left before he called the Fornituras. And that includes a GoPro, a digital camera, a laptop, and all of his clothes.
So this would have been like the stuff that he had with him in DR?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Now, once the family got back all of his stuff, because they were like, you took his stuff, give it fucking here. They went through everything and they did some digging and uncovered some weird shit. So while Daryl and Matt were on the island, Rigby was sending him emails instead of calling him and texting him.
Okay.
Just sending emails. No other form of communication. Very weird.
The only explanation, let me rephrase. The only plausible explanation I could see for that is that they didn't have anything other than Wi-Fi. So you would, or you didn't want to use like part of your phone plan or upgrade your phone plan to be international. That's about the only thing that I could see that being a thing.
Well, Daryl was calling and texting his mom repeatedly.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. His good phone point. Worked. Good point. Okay. Yeah. I'll also point out, too, that just because you lawyer up does not mean that you are guilty. I think it's very smart to lawyer up, especially if you have to go talk to police in any way, shape, or form. However, that coupled with the fact that he took all of Daryl's stuff is like, dude, can you just try to look a little less sketchy?
Yeah. So we kind of are going to fast forward a bit to May. So after the wallet's found.
May of this year?
No, May of that year.
Okay.
Which is, we're still in 2016.
Okay, sorry. I didn't know how far fast in the future.
Yeah, that year. Daryl's phone magically appears now. Apparently, what had happened was the phone was found in February in a rental car that was returned by Matt Rigby the day that Daryl had gone missing.
I'm starting to get a sense that this guy's
so
a real piece of shit.
Suspicious. An employee found the phone left in the back seat of the car. And he had left it at the office for a couple days to see if anyone would come and claim it.
Mm-hmm.
After it had not been claimed, the phone was then wiped clean by another employee and given to his girlfriend.
Wow.
Also, who the fuck knows how to wipe clean gadgets like that? Just lickety split. Like, everything goes. Put your hand down.
I do.
You're implicating yourself.
Sorry. I'm just saying, it's not actually as difficult as you would mm-hmm. think. But it is interesting to me because, I mean, I guess at that point, he hadn't contacted the embassy. So, like, there wasn't an active investigation going on. So there was mm-hmm. nothing for, like, the police. There's no reason that the police would have gone there to look for that, or that people in the office would have thought, oh, maybe we should turn this in because this guy's part of an active police investigation. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, there wouldn't have been any connection between the two.
Yeah. So investigators from the U.S. and the Dominican Republic were reportedly locked in legal disputes and efforts to retrieve records from the phone companies. It was weeks later after the phone being found that the family members say they noticed an alert on Daryl's online account with his cell phone company saying his phone had been deactivated.
Okay.
This allowed authorities in the Dominican Republic to track the phone down to an acquaintance of the rental car company, which is how they were able sure. to find out where the fucking phone was.
Sure. Okay.
So I'm going to say, let's look at Matt Rigby for a minute. Let's understand some weird facts here. Rigby was questioned by the authorities and cooperated, but nothing had come out of it.
Okay.
Now, here are some questions that kind of point some fingers at Rigby and his weird behavior.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
He left a note for Daryl when he left the island in the kitchen of the villa that they shared, but took all of Daryl's personal items with him when he left. So why would you leave a note, but then take all of his stuff with you?
In case he comes back, you know.
Right, taking just all the stuff case. That he could communicate with yeah. you with.
Yeah. Okay, that's...
So, two, he returned the rental car to Puerto Plata at 12:30 p.m. He told everyone that he was on his way home at 9:30 p.m., there's a 3-hour unaccounted window that he okay. does not say what he was doing or where he was.
And he returned the rental car the day after Daryl had supposedly disappeared?
It was on, I believe it was Thursday. It was Thursday when he actually left because he called the Fornituros on Friday.
Okay. Okay.
And Daryl supposedly had went missing on Wednesday.
On Wednesday. Okay. So he took the rental car back, but then, okay, got mm-hmm. it. Got it, got it, got it.
There also was an additional 100 miles tracked on the car's mileage.
Okay.
So not at all the distance that it would take to go from the rental to the villa and back.
Yeah.
Like, there was an additional 100 miles estimated on there. So,
damn.
Like, where are you driving? 100 yeah. miles is that's kind a bit. Of a lot.
That is a bit.
There's also camera footage at the airport showing Rigby entering a bathroom and leaving in a completely different pair of clothing, including sunglasses and a hat.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Rigby also ducked out of an interview with the U.S. Embassy and then told them to speak to his lawyer, and he never actually spoke with the U.S. Embassy.
Okay.
And then we also know that he had emailed yeah. Daryl instead of texting yeah. or calling him. So these are all these, like, weird, suspicious things that were
definitely
happening.
Definitely suspicious, I would mm-hmm. say.
Now, let's fast forward to June of this year. Okay. Well, last year, technically. It's 2020 now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yes.
The recent deaths of the tourists in the DR brought back to the attention of the U.S. the missing persons case of Daryl Fornituro. There have been no updates in the case since 2016. The DR is not wow. actively looking at the case. Only the Fornituros have kept up the fight to look for Daryl.
Okay. And I'm assuming nobody's been charged or anything in this nope. case. Okay.
Nope. Jeez. There is still a $25,000 reward being offered for any information leading to his recovery.
Okay.
And anyone with information on his whereabouts is urged to call the embassy tip line at 809-368-7713. And there's also a Facebook page called Searching for Daryl.
Okay.
Now, I told you I was going to circle back to what I thought happened.
Yes. Yeah. Please tell me.
So, my
these are just our opinions, by the way.
This is just
nobody's been charged.
My thought is that a couple of things probably happened. He probably went on that surf trip and got shaked down.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably did smoke something that was laced.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it sounds like to me, too.
And he was probably very, very paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing about him walking off, I don't think he did. All of the suspicious activity that Matt Rigby is involved in, mm-hmm. I think he knows what happened to Daryl. And I think it's more along the lines of some sort of an accident.
Yeah.
I think that there were people who were trying to steal from him and trying to drug him to steal from him. And I think what wound up happening is that his paranoia overcame him and probably something happened by accident and Rigby witnessed it and then tried to kind of cover it up because you're in a foreign country, you're a U.S. national. Like,
right.
I'm thinking that's, to me, what all of these weird conflicting and conflated facts are pointing to.
Well, and part of me, because it sounds like, obviously, if he's like a small planes operator that's friends with a tennis pro, that he is probably somebody with some stature, some prominence, some wealth, more than likely, if you're vacationing in the DR for like 5 days. I'm sure it would be a little more frightening, or you would be less inclined to actively help if it would reflect badly on your character, even if he didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that he did necessarily. I'm saying some of the decisions that he made following Daryl's disappearance were not the greatest. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at that, anybody can see that. And it does seem like he is, it seems for sure like he is trying to hide something. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have like a threat of getting yourself into trouble in that situation, when you have a lot of money, when you have a lot of influence or something, even over a like small community or whatever, mm-hmm. You're less likely to come forward because you almost have more to lose, you know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So I can definitely see that not necessarily being the cause of his death, but like you said, like maybe witnessed something or was aware of something happening and isn't being, it's possible that he's not being totally truthful. It's very mm-hmm. possible.
Yeah. There were so many things and holes in his timeline mm-hmm. and suspicious behavior. Like if your friend goes missing and you don't contact anyone, I understand you're in a shady part of the country, but like,
yeah,
call the embassy,
at least the embassy. Yeah.
Call back to the U.S. Ask somebody what you should do. You obviously have a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Call your lawyer and be like, he's missing. What should I do? Who should I contact?
Right. Yeah.
And I'm sure that, you know, if you went to the local police, there's obviously going to be a language barrier. There's not a whole lot of people in the local departments who speak English.
Yeah. I am kind of interested in why they were so quick to just shut that shit down. It seemed to me like the police were very quick to be like, nope, it's closed. We're not talking about it. He drowned. And like, not actively. It didn't sound like they did any sort of active investigation and that they're continuing not to.
The only thing that they attempted to do, but it wasn't local police, this was the country, was to look into his phone records.
Mm-hmm. I mean, would they just not want like the bad press? Is that definitely why they would just be like, mm-hmm.
that's why all of those things that happened this past year mm-hmm. was so scathing, because it was able to, like, everything got happened within like a week and a half span,
right? Yeah,
of
I remember
all those
that.
People being, you know, who died and the woman who was beaten, like that all happened super quickly.
Yeah.
So it is bad. And that happened in a tourist area. That happened mm-hmm. in a resort area. Mm-hmm. So imagine the amplitude of that, but also like just the country as a whole is a tourist destination, right? So even if you're not in the safe areas, they don't want that reputation to be ruined.
Yeah.
Of people not being able to go to a safe country to vacation.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, so he's still missing, and there really hasn't been any updates, but you can go onto the Facebook page and kind of see some other additional investigations, and I put the posters up here that mm-hmm. People kept getting it ripped down, and then there was a nice little map. So it shows you Cabarrota is really high up there in the north.
Oh, yeah, like way north.
We were in the way down. We were kind of closer to Puerto Rico area, kind of like down that way. So,
wild story.
Yep. Vacations are a nightmare.
If you're thinking of going on vacation, stop.
Don't.
pause, consider it while you listen to this podcast. Yeah,
stay at home and listen to podcasts where it's safe. Where you can go on an auditory vacation.
An auditory hallucination?
Murder Road Trip is a true crime podcast where I, your host, Haley, discuss murder cases in my car, aka the Mobile Beats Lab. Join me and my partner in crime, H.H. Gnomes, on the road. There will be games, mixtapes, and snacks as I make the research journey to murder scenes around the world. Make sure to check your back seat, and I'll see you at the next rest stop.
All right, Janelle.
Yes.
What do you got for me this week?
Well, I have one iTunes review.
Okay. I'm ready.
It's a short and a sweet one. It says, "Good time, crime cast." And it's a bunch of random numbers and letters, so I think it's like a computer-generated one. I mean, the name. They probably didn't put a name in, so probably computer-generated.
I was like, the comment is, and then I was like, oh, shit, we got bots. No. We got botted.
So it says, "I love this show so much." And that was it.
Oh, short, well, thank you.
And sweet and wonderful. Thank you for your iTunes review.
Thank you, bot.
Anytime you want to leave us one, head on over there. We appreciate it.
We love reading them. So we're in the new year. Mm-hmm. If you want the new year, new you, why don't you start with some new merch?
Yeah.
We've got shirts and bags and mugs and all sorts of things. You can find them all at thebadtastecrimecast.com/merch.
And while you're on there, you can head on over to the donate side and check there's a button what that's for that. All about.
There's a button for
you
donate.
You can become one of our lovely Patreon subscribers.
Mm. Yeah, Janelle's doing some fun shit over there now.
It's exclusive stuff that you can't listen to anywhere else. You have to be a Patreon member. You can hear amazing backlogged episodes, seasonal stuff.
Yes.
Maybe some live event things coming up. You get all kinds of codes for merch, all kinds of stuff. And you can hear me and my boyfriend Bo talking cocktails and conspiracies.
Which is always a good time.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Outrage. Yeah. Drinks are flying.
You can find that all at Patreon. It's badtastecrimecast.com/donate. Also, speaking of events and things, we are going to be at the True Crime Podcast Festival 2020 in Kansas City, Missouri on July 11th and 12th.
You can get some barbecue while you're down there, Vicky.
Maybe.
I'm
not a big barbecue person. Like, I don't actively seek it out necessarily, but I mean, I will eat it and I enjoy it when I do.
Is
Kansas City a big barbecue area? I've actually not been there, I don't think.
Kansas City's a real big one.
Oh, well, maybe we'll have to get some barbecue.
It's like Kansas City and Memphis are like...
Yeah. Nashville. Nashville had good barbecue when I was there.
They're more of a hot chicken town.
Yeah. I didn't realize that until we left and we saw a place called Hot Chicken something. And I was like, what the fuck is hot chicken?
Down there
I would not like that.
Oh, it's delicious. If I ate meat, it's...
I don't like spicy, really.
But you can get varying degrees. It's just like a little spicy. But we went down there the first time to visit my brother and we got it. And Bo had... the flu and he couldn't eat it and I was just describing it to him. I'm like, it's spicy and it's sweet and it's delicious.
Oh my god.
I felt so bad. He was laying on the bathroom floor like just dying and I'm like, I'm gonna eat this hot chicken and pimento mac and cheese and you can fuck off.
So
it's true love.
Barbecue. Yes. So we're gonna be in Kansas City, Missouri, July 11th and 12th. For that, you can check out more information at tcpf2020.com. They'll have tickets are available. See all the shows that are gonna be down there. There's a ton of people going. We're excited because our sound producer Tiff's coming with us. It's gonna be so fun. I can't wait. We're gonna road trip.
We're gonna scare her.
Yeah. Oh my god, that's true. This is like the first podcast trip away also, which is gonna be really fun. I'm pretty excited and we're excited to meet you guys. What I think that's all we got.
Yeah,
for I sound so surprised, like, is that it?
I mean, it is.
All right, our sound producer is Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, the Enigma.
I had already forgotten you.
That is like my new favorite. I'm so glad Tiff got that for me for Christmas because it's the best. I just can't get enough of it. It's so good. We will see you in 2 weeks. Adios. Are you going to say goodbye?
No.
Oh. All right. Well, I'll say bye for Janelle. Bye.
You can say bye. I don't know. I'll say bye.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form or another.